Unit 7, Training Techniques, continues with this podcast, which is covering types of training techniques. That's where we will jump into the very specific possibilities that are available to you in terms of the types of techniques that you might use. The first are lectures. You're familiar with lectures. You've sat through many, I'm sure. Lectures are a very traditional format where a speaker speaks to an audience, uses a lecture format, and, of course, shares information via that format. Now, the advantages of lectures is that they're low cost, and that they're widely used, so people have been exposed to the format before. There's nothing novel about a lecture necessarily. I mean, the content might be novel, but the actual technique, you won't surprise people by asking them to sit quietly while they're lectured to. It can be time effective. You can cover a great deal of material in a short amount of time in a lecture. That being said, there are some drawbacks too, but we'll get to those shortly. They can be highly organized, and probably the most effective reason for thinking about a lecture is they can accommodate large audiences. So if you've got a large audience, let's say the training is with 300 people versus 30. You can do a lot more things with 30 people than you could with 300. So if you're trying to train 300 folks, lectures might make sense. To be effective, lectures need to take on these considerations. They should be short. So we mentioned above that the lectures can be highly organized. But you don't want them to just run on and on and on. So they can be highly organized, but they could also be truncated or blocked, chopped up into shorter bits. So it's helpful to, and you know, what might punctuate those? You could simply use breaks, if you will, to create shorter blocks of lecture. Or you could build in some activities to appeal to that kinesthetic type of learning, or some visuals. You may show a video to appeal to the visual learner. So those kinds of things that break up the lecture content into shorter units. That, of course, obviously will help people maintain their attention if you do that kind of truncation of the lecture format. It's also important to contain pertinent examples and illustrations. Those are always helpful for people. As I mentioned, visuals help people that are visual learners. Anything auditory helps auditory learners. It's important in a lecture format not to just be lecturing, but to demonstrate the need for training, to drive home the point that this information that we're talking about, that I am as the lecturer essentially talking to you about, will be important to you in these ways. So they don't just feel like they're being lectured to, but there is some appeal to the fact that this will make some sense to them in terms of application. All right, and that's why it's important to conclude lectures with a direct appeal for putting the training to use, that you implore the people now to go out and take what you've learned here and to make it, in fact, work for you in your actual daily processes. To learn more about the pitfalls of lectures and technical training, I found this particular 7 Deadly Sins of Technical Training, and it's from a trainer in England, but you don't need to necessarily attend his workshop. I think it's already happened, to be honest. But go ahead and link to the YouTube clip here, and you can get a better sense of what he thinks are some of the 7 deadly sins of technical training, which is essentially the lecture format, what you need to be aware of when you're using a lecture format. Go ahead and pause the podcast at this point and come back to it shortly. In addition to lectures, we can also use what are called self-assessment instruments when we're training. Now, you've become familiar with these probably because many of the ones that you would use in a needs assessment could also be used here because they're self-assessment instruments. They're ways for people to figure out where they stand in terms of certain behaviors or orientations or feelings about their workplace or the kind of work they do or how they interact with their colleagues. All that can be very helpful. However, you have to be careful with the self-assessments. You don't want people to feel like they're branded once they identify themselves as a type A personality, for example, because you don't want everybody in the workplace to then be seen forward from that point on as a type, I can't work with Joe because he's a type A guy. That's what he is, and I can't deal with him. I'm not type A. So that becomes problematic. So we don't want to necessarily create these type descriptions and put people in boxes, if you will, right? It's helpful for them to understand their position relative to a spectrum of behaviors. Think of these things and understand that you have to help them understand and think of these things as tendencies. They're not always unequivocally the way in which that behavior would be described. It's a tendency that they might have. Important to understand tendencies, but not to feel boxed in by a description. All right, so these can be particularly helpful for creating an understanding for group or individual behavior, as we mentioned. It's also really helpful because they create a common vocabulary. So in my example before, you say, oh, I can't work with Joe because he's a type A personality. Well, that's blaming, you know, that's giving an excuse for why you can't work with somebody because of their personality. It's boxing them in, as we said. But the important piece here is everybody in the room now knows what a type A personality is, right? So that's a common vocabulary. People are putting words, vocabulary, terms to some of their lived experience. So they may not know what to call somebody who's really always kind of edgy and needs to get things done on time and so on and so forth. Type A gives them an opportunity to kind of conceptualize what that is, along with any other number of kind of terms that might be helpful. And as we said, those things, not only vocabulary, but learning a little bit more about ourselves and others in the workplace gives us some feedback about how we fit relative to them, helps us in that human relations dimension of knowing how we can and do work with others and the differences that exist in those workplaces. What are some of the drawbacks? Interestingly enough, whenever you try to do these things, and this has been my experience, you always run into criticism of the instruments. People don't want to believe, and fairly so. I mean, as we've already made the point clear, you don't want to box people in, you don't want to categorize. I mean, people don't want to believe that they can be so easily categorized by answering, let's say, a set of 10 questions. And truthfully, they can't. But they're going to take that out on the instrument, is what they tend to do. They're going to critique the instrument and say, well, you know, how can you learn? How can this be accurate? And truthfully, it's accurate because the instruments have held up across many groups of people. And again, they're only telling us about tendencies. They're not unequivocally deterministic in the sense that if you respond this way, it makes you this kind of person. It doesn't work that way. It's not making anyone anything. It's reflecting how they might be. So a difference and an important one. But expect to get some criticism when you are doing this. So you have to be ready and prepared to deal with the criticism of the instruments. People will feel vulnerable and exposed by what is revealed about them, perhaps. And taking the results is to be definitive. We kind of covered that ground. And last one there is kind of an important idea, too. It might produce more feedback than people are willing to take on. They don't want to do that kind of self-reflection, so they may not necessarily be comfortable doing it. That's an important consideration as well. So what are some guidelines to help you use self-assessment tools in an effective way? First, stress the temporal nature of the measure. It reflects one point in time. It's a snapshot. It doesn't mean somebody is this way unequivocally. It's maybe a tendency they have. It's how they reported in this instance. Those things can be helpful. Also clarify there are no right or wrong answers when you do these self-assessment instruments. People might feel like there's one way to answer this or one way to respond. That's not necessarily true. We want to avoid the strict categorization of people, obviously. We want to keep the scoring simple. We want to make sure the directions are clear. And most importantly, we want to reserve time for discussing the outcomes of these self-assessment instruments. It's really unfortunate if we administer one or two of these and then don't allow the proper time for people to think through, discuss, talk about, question what this means for them and their coworkers and how they behave with one another. So that's a really important thing to be able to make sure you have time for discussing those. Let's move now to case studies. Case studies are real or fictionalized examples of workplace issues or problems. Many of you have probably run into these already in your undergraduate courses. So you're familiar with the model or the technique. And we use cases to kind of demonstrate and identify with problems. It's often very helpful because it allows people to step outside of their particular context. So the case is not about them, but it might be about issues that they're in fact dealing with. So it's more comfortable to see these fictionalized characters dealing with an issue or real characters in another organization that they face in their organization. Obviously, cases can vary in the length of complexity that they have, and they need to be chosen according to all the kinds of constraints we've talked about before. If you have a time limit, you've got to choose a case study that's less complex and not as involved to get through it and to have appropriate time to discuss it. So appropriate use of case studies needs to involve these things, clearly stating the objectives of the case. You don't want people working through a case and not knowing why they're doing it. What's the purpose of this case? So you want to preface the case before people engage with it and say, this is a case about organizational citizenship behavior. How do people go above and beyond the call of duty in their organization to behave in ways that benefit others? So that's what we're trying to recognize in this case study. Keep that in mind when you're working through it and reading it. We want to be able to guide and facilitate the discussion of the case, obviously. It's important to have readers be very clear about their positions, where they're coming from, and the conclusions they're drawing about what they see in the case. And it's helpful to coach people when they're using the case study so that they know that they're leading to or coming to a particular solution. Now, the cases that we use in training should address issues faced by trainees. They shouldn't be so abstract that they are irrelevant to them. And they obviously should allow for discussion about numerous factors contributing to an issue or concern versus a single solution. We want to avoid cases that present a very specific right way to do something. Because, be honest and be truthful, that's not the way organizations work. There are many ways to do something, some more optimal than others. So we're not looking for case studies that say, look, this is the way this should be done. We're looking for case studies that force people to think through the possible outcomes and to make decisions based on what would be best, what are the trade-offs, what are the possibilities. Have them work through those considerations so they come to a conclusion. It could be a better or worse conclusion or solution, but at least they've worked through the process and they haven't been guided to a specific right answer. The cases are effective because they do a handful of things, right? They deter people from making snap judgments. You can't work through a case study and say, well, this is the way it would work, because they should be complex enough to suggest to people that there would be, as we said, many ways to sort through it and work through it. Similarly, they show that one correct answer is rarely the case. They also illustrate how people can perceive events differently. So you might have several people working through a case or in fact the people in the case, both of which could be true, coming to different conclusions, right? Drawing different conclusions from the same set of circumstances or facts. They facilitate discussion about topics, and that's really important in terms of resolving problems. So they kind of indicate to people that discussion is an important form of coming to problem resolution. And finally, they provide viewpoints that may not have been considered by people in the training and development previously. So they could, in the very essence, be a learning moment where new solutions or ideas are presented that people hadn't thought about as ways to move forward. Small group activities is yet another type of training technique, and this involves, as the name would suggest, breaking people into small groups to do an activity. And they afford greater synergy, obviously, and social interaction when you have small groups. I mentioned the 300 versus 30. If you've got 300 people, you could certainly break them into smaller groups. When you have 30, you ideally should break them into small groups. When you've got a group of 30, you could have them in groups of, you could have six groups of five, for example. You're going to get a much higher degree of synergy and social interaction with five people in a group than you would in the larger cohort of 30. Small groups are great because they can foster that cooperative environment, right? Get people cooperating. So you can be doing any number of kinds of activities, regardless of what it is in terms of the small group. But any number of those will kind of capitalize on these benefits that are derived from small groups, the synergy, the cooperativeness, the social interaction. On the flip side, the small groups can run the risk of falling prey to something called groupthink, which I have to assume you've seen in your other coursework elsewhere. But very quickly, groupthink is this idea that groups come to conclusions without enough or any critical thinking about where they're headed in their decision-making process. Said another way, there aren't enough members contradicting the prevailing opinion, saying, wait a minute, we need to consider this, playing devil's advocate and saying, what about this? Or here's a flaw with that thinking. Or here's an issue that somebody needs to raise. There isn't enough of that going around because there's too much of an emphasis put on consensus. There's too much goodwill put on, let's get through this and get finished with the process, and not spend time contradicting one another. We want to be coherent and cohesive and cooperative. All those things that we said are, by their very nature, helpful in groups. There can be too much of that with groupthink. And as a result, you end up with poor decisions. Okay, finally, the role of facilitators is critical in small groups, and they should, it's important that they should guide. You know, somebody that's a good small group facilitator understands the difference between guiding and influencing a group. You don't want to give them particular suggestions of coming to a particular conclusion, but you certainly want to give them prompts, maybe, to guide them to get there. So that's an important distinction. Okay, next are activities and role playing. And this is a special subset of training techniques that we'll spend some time on. They're designed to put people into situations that would mimic real life occurrences, right? By their very nature, they can be incredibly powerful because they play on kinesthetic learning and activity-based learning, which we already know is quite important for adult learners, right? It's about participation. It's not just sitting through lectures. It's not just information training. It's getting up and physically partaking and doing something. So it engages multiple levels of multiple modes of learning, and it really plays on the participation piece of training that's so important with adult learners. Now, that being said, adult learners are not always and not necessarily and sometimes mostly not comfortable with role-playing. So you have to put them in situations where that isn't so intimidating and they can be comfortable. And there are ways to do that, which I will come to here shortly. But before saying how you can make people more comfortable in role plays, let's talk a little more about generally the overview of what needs to happen in a role play. It's not enough to just simply do a role play, right? Have you been a part of a role play where you simply did the role play and you thought, what was the point of that? There needs to be some real consideration to debriefing and talking about what happened in the role play. So you not only complete the activity, but you solicit feedback, right? I'm saying role play now here. It doesn't have to be a role play specifically, but any experiential activity. You need to complete the activity. Then solicit feedback. You want people to talk about and think through what happened during the activity, right? They need to not only think about that and be able to talk about it, but they need to share their feedback with others. So not just, for example, maybe writing feedback on a form that you provide, but in some group setting, in some discussion feedback setting. Then it's important to try to get them to highlight the themes that are apparent there. Now, what kind of common experience did people have from going through the activity? What did they learn about trust, for example, if we did a trust activity? Ideally, if it's a well-designed activity to begin with and it's well executed, they'll be able to say, here are a couple things we learned about trust, and that's going to help us when we go back to our work group. And finally, obviously, you want to seek application. So how will it help them when they go back to their workplace? Well, and this group now, group members will know that we can trust one another, and this will play out in X, Y, and Z ways in the workplace. So processing the activity, obviously, is very critical to its success. So we want to make sure that we do that. Let's move now more specifically to role-playing. And just for fun, I've dropped in here. You're all probably familiar, even if you don't watch it, because it's been somewhat notable as a television series. The series called The Office, the American version, was in fact based on a British television series of the same name. And the characters are similarly positioned. So they of course, have the same kind of boss that's problematic and the similar other cast of characters. I've put a YouTube clip in here of one of the classic episodes there, which was when they had a training and development consultant come in and they were going to try to do a role play. So role plays can be incredibly powerful, but they can go horribly awry. Take a second and enjoy this YouTube clip from the UK version of The Office to get a sense of how horribly wrong they can go, and then come on back. All right, so in there you can see David Brent is the UK equivalent of the guy who runs the paper. In this case, there's a paper plant in the UK version, and he's kind of difficult to deal with. He's one of these guys who thinks he knows more than he does, and so he really kind of undermines the entire role play and takes it in a very different direction. And that can happen to you, so you got to be prepared for that. So let's talk about some strategies for making role playing A, more comfortable for people involved, and B, more manageable if, in fact, you do run into difficult people. The variations in role-playing can be role reversal, which is an interesting thing to do. You can have people playing the roles, and you know, because some people might be reluctant to play one role and wish they were in a different role. And then